Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, your regular chance to gather round and chat about the most exciting developments in the high-tech world. My name's Bobby Johnson and I'm standing in for Alex Kwiatkowski to bring you an inside look at the latest news, views and to-dos in technology. This week we're going to go on a journey and spend the show visiting a new academic institution that has an ambitious goal: to change the world. And on top of that, as always, we'll be hearing the latest news headlines. So strap on your jetpack and get ready to fly into tomorrow. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
There's a big difference between linear and exponential growth. If I take 30 steps linearly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I get to 30. If I take 30 steps exponentially, 2, 4, 8, 16, I get to a billion. It makes a huge difference. And that really describes information technology. When I was a student at MIT, we all shared one computer, took up a whole building. The computer in your cell phone today is a million times cheaper, a million times smaller, 1,000 times more powerful. That's a billion-fold increase in capability per dollar that we've actually experienced since I was a student. And we're going to do it again in the next 25 years.
Earlier this year, at the TED conference in California, the futurist Ray Kurzweil surprised the world by announcing plans to launch a university dedicated to teaching cutting-edge technologies and future studies. It was something he called the Singularity University, an ambitious, and some would say slightly off the wall, attempt to hasten the arrival of rapid technological change.
Our goal was to assemble the leaders, both teachers and students, in these exponentially growing information technologies and their application. But Larry Page made an impassioned speech at our organizing meeting saying we should devote this study to actually addressing some of the major challenges facing humanity. And if we did that, Google would back this.
Just a few months after it first hit the headlines, the project gathered financial backing from the likes of Google and NASA. And last week, the first set of students graduated from the university's inaugural summer course after more than 2 months of intensive training. I went to the campus in Mountain View, California, to find out what was going on, and that's where I met with Salim Ismail, the university's executive director. How does it work? Who takes part? And what exactly do they learn? I asked Salim to explain more.
There's a basic observation that if you look at the biggest issues that we're facing today, whether it's the financial crisis, whether it's swine flu and pandemics, and arguably climate change, they're all rooted in accelerated and exponential factors. Yet our leadership around the world, politically or business-wise, does not have a good handle on these. The next generation of leaders had better have a better understanding of these dynamics so that they can address these issues better. So we're going to need to learn how to use technology in an effective way. Low cost, easily deployable, easily distributed, self-replicating, whatever the means are, to address some of these issues. So essentially that's the mandate of Singularity University.
That's only a small one then.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. It's a niche topic.
So the way you're looking at things from the university's point of view, you're teaching people over, or you're giving them skills over the course of
nine weeks
to effectively, I don't know, fix the future.
Not fix, but leverage and manage. You know, how do you spot an exponential trend? Because an exponential growth curve looks linear early in its life cycle. Then it hits the knee of the curve, and then you have a major issue. Pandemics is a classic example. How do you do early detection, and you can nip it in the bud, right? And how do you deploy vaccines that you can manufacture locally rather than having to ship them all out, because that's never going to scale? Well, let me give you the basic thesis behind Ray's work. Right. So Ray made the observation that Moore's Law, which has showed unfettered growth in computing for the last 60 years, that exponential growth comes from the information properties of that domain. And that any domain that acquires information properties and becomes an information science essentially goes into exponential growth. For example, we've now sequenced the genome. Medicine is essentially an information science and is now going into exponential growth and showing rapid development very, very fast. And there's a basket of these areas like nanotech, biotech, AI and robotics, medicine, etc., that are all in this world. So in order to manage all of that, we need to understand the underpinnings of it all. And that's essentially what we're about. Peter Diamandis, who runs the XPRIZE Foundation, had founded 20 years ago an institution called the International Space University, which has developed a very effective 9-week summer program on the space industry, very interdisciplinary, a little bit like an executive MBA for the space world. And it was Peter's idea when he read Ray's book that you could use the educational model that he developed at ISU to apply to these technologies and have an effective way of getting them across. So they together approached the head of NASA, here is Pete Warden, who said got very excited and said, I'll host it. In September, they had a founding conference where they got together 50 or 60 thought leaders in the Bay Area and said, here's the basic premise. Are you interested? Would you like to get involved? Would you lend your networks, your expertise, your experience, your capital in helping build this institution out?
You've got 40 students here.
Yeah, in the first year. So year one is 40 students. And so what we've done is the International Space University that moves its summer program around year to year. This year they're here at Ames. So there's 120 students, and we're umbrellaing a little bit under their operational food, housing, student affairs, all of that stuff. And tacking on 40 students of our own on the side with a different curriculum. Next year, when they leave to go to another venue, we'll stay permanently based here and expand into that footprint. So the students arrive here. They live here on campus for the 9 weeks. It's a very intensive program. And every day is scripted completely as to what's going to happen. And the 9 weeks is broken up into roughly three phases. In phase one, they get an overview across all of these 10 disciplines. So they get either six or eight lectures into what is genetics, what are the basics of robotics, what is biotech. And now, you're not going to teach genetics in eight lectures, but you can give a smart person a good overview of the field. In the second phase, they pick one or two areas and they do a deep dive. Let's say it's robotics. They have lectures on what developments do we expect to see in the next 3 to 5 years in robotics. What is the 10-year vision for the space? Who are the top 5 or 7 labs or companies in the area, and let's go visit them and see what they're doing. Who are the top thinkers in the field, and let's bring them in and have them do guest lectures. So they think about all that. And one of the issues that we're all facing with is these rapidly moving technologies are moving so fast that nobody can keep pace. You're familiar with 3D printing. They now have 3D printing of human organs, where stem cell researchers are using 3D printers to spray layers of cells into the shape of, say, a kidney, and they goose it with stem cells, and there's your kidney. Now, I said to them, this is clearly very theoretical, and they said, no, there's several labs around the world that are very close to working prototypes. Now, that one development will completely change medicine, if I can print a body part, right? And yet, there may be 50 or 100 of those out there, and we don't know about them. So one issue in these areas is that these fields are moving so quickly that nobody can keep pace. And we're trying to get in one place a good snapshot of what is the state of the art and what do we expect to see coming down the pike. At the end of that second phase, where these 40 students have collectively explored these areas very aggressively, we probably have the best collective view of what is going to happen in the next few years as anywhere in the world. And we use that newly minted knowledge and flip them into the final third of the program, which is the team project. And it's a design project that thinks about addressing a global issue. So in this first year, the challenge we've thrown out of them is how would you improve the lives of 1 billion people within 10 years using accelerating technologies? Now, to do that, they'll have to think about affecting maybe 20, 30,000 people in year one, having that double every year is ongoing, and leverage the technologies that are coming into being. For example, 3D printing. What if you used a microfinance model to deploy 3D printers in different parts of the world? And as the resolution of the printing got better over the years that are coming, which we can plot very, very accurately, you'll be able to print teeth or tools or replacement parts. As it gets finer and finer, you should be able to print nanofilters for water and have clean water anywhere. And so that's one of the examples of the team projects that they're thinking about.
Where have the people who are on the course come from? What are their backgrounds? And where do you hope they go after this?
Right. So we filtered. Our criteria for accepting students was threefold. First, we wanted them to have a good academic background because we're not set up to teach deep academic rigor. We need the Oxfords, the Cambridges, the MITs, the Harvards for that. The second thing was that we wanted people that had already done something entrepreneurial or leadership oriented because, again, we're not set up to teach that. And the final criteria is they needed to have an expressed interest in global issues. We got, I think, 1,250 applications for the 40 slots. We filtered for those three areas, and then we had a big meeting for a day where we chose the final 40. We have a 35% female-to-male ratio. We have people from 13 different countries, about half based in the U.S., half from elsewhere, and average age of about 31. And so they have an extraordinary academic background. Clearly, if we had 40 nanotechnologists, it wouldn't be a good mix. So we thought carefully about how many of each discipline would we want ideally in that founding class. And we think we've succeeded. They've each done, some of them are qualified to teach some of the courses.
How are they paying their own way? Are they getting their companies to pay for them?
In most cases, so the official tuition is $25,000. In practice, about some companies have donated scholarships, and we offered scholarships to a few. So on average, they're paying about half that amount for room and board and the tuition for the 9 weeks and all the activities included. But most of them are paying for themselves in this group. Most of them have successful businesses. One of them has a $25 million business he runs on the side. A couple of them have built companies in the past. Several kind of leading product thinkers are in the mix. So they're fairly successful people that are coming to this.
That was Salim Ismail of the Singularity University there. Now, his job is pretty important. He runs a thing. But, of course, a university isn't worth much without its students. So who actually took part and how did they feel about it? The inaugural class of 40 consisted of a variety of disciplines, including physicists, doctors, lawyers, artists, designers, biologists and engineers from all over the world. After handing over their $25,000 and turning up in California, they were given the chance to learn about a variety of different fields and take part in a number of different projects. For the last couple of weeks, they teamed up to work on their own schemes. That included a peer-to-peer car sharing service called GetAround and a method for using 3D printing techniques to build homes in the developing world called a casa. We'll hear more about that in a moment, but first I met with a number of students to find out what their experience of Singularity U had been like. First up was Marianne Ryan, who explained to me how she'd come to the university and what it was she discovered during her time on campus.
I was already an interdisciplinary person, so I mentioned policy, law, and ethics. I'm also an attorney, but I have been doing a PhD in information science, so I know a lot about information technology. The one area that I did not know a lot about was medicine, bioinformatics, human enhancement. So that was what I was looking forward to learning a lot more about. And so it was interesting because I do have some colleagues here who are already doctors or are doing PhDs in bioinformatics. And so I thought it was going to be really challenging to develop a curriculum that would speak to them as well as to me. And somehow they managed to find the sweet spot in terms of my becoming much more knowledgeable over the summer and also giving those folks an opportunity to go on site visits and to see things in action. So it was a great experience for me. It totally raised my understanding of what are the emerging issues in those areas. And then I can tie it back thinking about what are the policy, law, and ethics challenges that medicine and bioinformatics are going to be facing as they try to commercialize all these new technologies we saw this summer.
Paint a picture for me of a site visit you went on.
Actually, there were a couple that stand out for me. One was Paul Sappho, who was just speaking here, arranged for us to go to a couple of places that were interesting. One was the Computer History Museum. So it's interesting to think about a lot of futurists visiting a place where we're talking about history, but I think it's really important for us not to forget about the fact that a lot of the technology around us that we take for granted was very transformative and disruptive in its own time, and it was sort of interesting to go back to this museum and revisit the story of how those came to be and how they managed to become a part of our everyday lives. And then going further from there, Paul allowed us to spend a day at the Long Now Foundation. They're trying to get people to be in the mindset of thinking about a 10,000-year horizon in terms of where the world is headed, and then making smart decisions to make sure that we do that in an intelligent way. And I thought the combination of thinking about the long past and then the long future was a fascinating context for us to have all the conversations that we're having, because we do feel a huge sense of responsibility about some of the decisions that we need to be making about how to deploy these technologies, because there's some uncertainty about what the outcomes could be. There's a lot of decisions that have to be made about where do we invest funding, what kind of regulatory structures do we want to have. And if you have that longer horizon about thinking about generations and not just sort of immediate short-term outcomes, which might be sort of the perspective of the Silicon Valley when they're thinking about investing. So we're trying to challenge ourselves to think long term. And I think that's one of the great outcomes of this summer, is that we'll walk away with that and we'll be able to be sort of ambassadors for that perspective and share it with other people.
My name is Sophia and I'm currently living in New York. I'm working on my master's in media studies and sociology there. I have a background in art, education, future studies, technology. I applied from Facebook. I had a friend who sent a link and I was like, this is exactly the right thing for me. So and I sent my application in and I waited, and I had these dreams about how I was going to get in, literally dreams. And one day I woke up and there was an email. It was a total shock.
Obviously you learn about lots of varied areas and disciplines.
Yeah.
But then you spend a bit of time kind of picking out ones that you want to learn more about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I want to know what were those ones for you, and what what you now know that you didn't when you started?
Mm-hmm. There was so much to learn that it was difficult to believe that you could actually retain everything that you heard. But a salient point for me was calling a friend of mine back in Boston and saying, well, here I am at NASA, I'm learning all these things, having a conversation about some technology, and all of a sudden all these facts kept surfacing about nanotech and networks and computing that I didn't anticipate, that I actually didn't think I retained. And so all of a sudden I found myself being able to talk about things that I just shouldn't be able to talk about.
When you go back to New York and, you know, and back in your normal life, what are the things that you'll take away?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's such a thing as a normal life after SU, and I've heard that from all of us, is that it just changes the way that you will see the world. And now when someone says anything less than 1 billion people, I'm not exaggerating, it doesn't seem like a big deal to me. I'm like, oh, not 1 billion people? Well, that's okay, you know? So the numbers, the scale is drastically changed. So the vision is so much bigger, and it actually, funny you should ask, just yesterday I almost, like 90% made the choice to drop out of grad school, stay here, and work full-time for CASA, and really push this technology forward. And it's worth the risk to me, and I really believe in what we're doing. And I think that that's true for a lot of the teams, that people are really behind, because you've invested so much into it, the research and the time and the passion, that you don't want to just like leave and drop it on the ground. And my short-term goal is to finish one semester. And at 6 months, if this company is in a place that I'm comfortable with, I'm going to drop everything and just come here.
But it's not just students like Marianne Ryan and Sophia Yampolsky who get to enjoy the benefits of the university's program. The faculty do too, and since there are more than 100 advisors, lecturers and experts donating their time, that means there's been plenty of activity taking place over the last couple of months. Tara Lemmy, an entrepreneur, academic and investor, was in charge of the university's policy, law and ethics track, and she told me that one surprising result of the course was how it brought together thinkers from very disparate fields.
There were over 100 faculty for just a handful of students, really, and we learned from each other. We learned how to think about engaging people in the dialogue, the hard questions that come up. The students are covering so much subject matter, and we don't. As the faculty, we cover ours, and we sit in as many of them as we can, so it's a real mashup of some of the most complicated, interesting, provocative ideas. Every conversation was a conversation cross-discipline, and so frequently people will end up in their own silos or their, you know, island of expertise. And here we ended up on a crazy island of people from all parts of the world with every discipline trying to figure out how each other's language works, because we had to form a sort of a new fluency. How do we understand the language of each discipline, and then how do we come up with a language that says this is how we talk about the future, which is sort of non-trivial and really fun. The good news is everybody, if you come to a startup university, you come sort of ready for any eventuality, and everybody was open-minded and willing to sort of invent as we go along.
Tara Lemmy of Lens Ventures there. Now we're going to take a short break from the singularity to hear this week's news read by our very own Scott Corley.
eBay has sold a 65% stake in the internet telephony company Skype to a group of private investors for $1.9 billion. The deal, which values the company at around the same $2.6 billion price that eBay paid for it in 2005, marks the latest attempt by the auction website to return to its core business after several years of trying to branch out. Facebook has been forced to tighten its privacy rules, giving users much greater control of the information they share online. The changes, which will take up to a year to implement, came after complaints from the Canadian government. The British games industry is once again seeking tax breaks to try and bolster the country's position worldwide. The calls came after a survey by the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts found that Britain was in danger of slipping from its position as home of the world's third largest games industry down to fifth, and possibly even lower. And Microsoft apologised last week after marketing material in Poland appeared to switch the race of one of the subjects. The picture, originally taken for one of the company's American campaigns, had featured a black man in the middle of the photograph, but when the image appeared on the company's Polish site, his face had been replaced by that of a badly photoshopped white man. The software giant apologised and said it was investigating the incident.
Thanks for that, Scott. And remember, if you want to read the latest technology news, then check out our website at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, let's return to California and the Singularity University. Its approach of taking exponentially growing problems and trying to solve them using exponentially growing technologies is certainly ambitious. But enough of humanity's future. What's the future for the institution itself? Is this an experiment? Is it just a boondoggle for a few people who can afford to attend? What's going to happen in the future? I went back to ask Salim Ismail, the executive director, what the university had planned for the coming years.
We think there's kind of three main types of output. First is companies and projects that get spun off. The second is somebody may come up with interesting research ideas that might get funded by Intel or by Cisco or by a biotech company to fund a specific piece of research. And the third is publicly funded projects that are looking to address some major issue or not. And so we have people from various different fields. When they come out of this, at least half of them have said they want to go and address an issue or start a company or get involved with one of the public issues that we have out there.
And from your perspective, how has it gone so far? Have you had to make tweaks along the way?
Oh yeah, we're tweaking almost nonstop. This is essentially a real-time institution. Every day we have an agenda. When we see that something, we've got too much density of content, say in networks and computing, we tweak it so that the next week we have slightly less. It's just-in-time university, basically. But it's gone very, very well. I don't think we expected it to be this spectacularly successful. I think if OK was 5 out of 10, we're at about 8 or 9 out of 10. And given this is our first year, and we've never done this before, absolutely it's a 10 out of 10. Every week or two, we've had some extraordinary figure come by and chat with the students. So Peter Thiel today, last week Esther Dyson dropped by for half a day, Vince Cerf has come by and spent an afternoon evening with the students, Bob Metcalf, who invented Ethernet, has come by. So we've had quite an extraordinary set of folks come through, meet the students, kind of give them a sense of how they think about various problem spaces. And it's left the students with quite a knowledge base and a very experiential grounding in what they want to do next.
If somebody wanted to take part next year in this, or one of the other programs that I'm sure you're running or will be running in between, how do they stand out? What is it? What is the X factor that people have that you're looking for?
If you add those three criteria up, they're at the top of their field, they've got a deep academic background, they've done something business or entrepreneurial leadership or leadership focused, and have an expressed interest in global issues, that narrows the field fairly considerably. Now you have to create the time. I'm finding 9 weeks to come and live here, leaving your family behind, your business behind, your career behind is not an easy task. So this is where we focus on graduate students who are in the middle of either just finished or in the middle of their doctorates or master's degrees. But we ask each of them to write up why they're interested in coming, and that gives us a very good insight into how they think about these issues and the angle that they're coming, the perspective they bring to the table. And what we found that's been extraordinary is the mix of quantum computing experts, with medical doctors, with biotech experts, with nanotech experts, with some policy law experts. And the speed of that has utterly surprised us. I'll give you a small example. One of the students in one of the finance and entrepreneurship lectures registered a domain name, so started selling Google ads and bought some keywords on it, marketed it, threw up a web page, and started generating revenue for this little idea by the end of the lecture. And we were gobsmacked. I mean, that was unbelievable.
You know, another organization that kind of reminds me or has similar outlook or it pulls people together is something like Intellectual Ventures.
Yes.
Except they, in terms of, you know, pulling people together, multidisciplinary, yes. Get them in a room, get them to talk with each other. I mean, their objective is to create patents,
yes.
So that they can own future technologies. This is flipping that completely on its head and saying, we want these people to go out there and...
Yes, we're completely open source. We're a non-profit educational institution, and so our mandate is to spread the awareness as much as possible. We're taping all of the lectures. We'll make as many of them as available as we can. We want thousands of students and thousands of people to have the interaction with the content that we've got. We've managed to get 60 or 80 of the world's top speakers to speak about the most aggressively growing technologies in the world. That is incredibly valuable, and we want that to be made available. And the board and the trustees that have funded this institution want that to be out there and open.
Who then, from your personal perspective, I'm not asking you to pick your favorite child or anything, but
sure.
which are the speakers you've had that have given you the most?
We had Andrew Hessel speaking about synthetic biology. That was extraordinary. Bob Metcalf spoke about using internet principles to revolutionize the energy world. Fascinating cross-disciplinary thinking. Ralph Merkel, who is a global expert in nanotechnology, talking about where nanotech can go. One of the students, Shai Machnez, who's Israeli, is a quantum computing expert. And he was able to demonstrate that within a decade we should have room temperature superconductivity using quantum computing. That has enormous implications. So we've had some pretty extraordinary experiences here. Peter Bloom, who's the head of General Atlantic Ventures, came and gave a talk about failures and where he's made mistakes in the past, which gave people an insight as to how to think about taking risk. And so we've had some pretty exceptional speakers.
That was Salim Ismail, and if you want to find out more about the Singularity University, you can go to singularityu.org or read this week's Technology Guardian, which hits the streets on Thursday. In fact, while we're here, let's tell you what else you can find in Technology Guardian this week. Inside its crisp and colourful pages, you'll also be able to read an interview with the legendary David Bailey on the rise of digital photography. You'll get an inside look of what's really going on with knowledge engine Wolfram Alpha, and there's opinion pieces from Cory Doctorow and Victor Keegan, among others. All that and much more, as usual, in this week's Technology Guardian, which you can get this Thursday with The Guardian. Now, just time to mention a few of your comments before we sign off for another 7 days. Last week's show mentioned the struggle by price comparison website Foundom to get noticed by Google. An issue that demonstrates the impact that search engines can have on small businesses. Colm Joyce left a comment suggesting that the Google bug effect is replacing the butterfly effect, which is very clever and, I suppose, to some extent true. We also had some kind comments on Twitter, including from Alice Northover, as well as retweets from quite a few listeners, including Jocelyn, Provis and Paul Miller. Thanks to all of you, and we're always happy when you can spread the word. Now you can follow the show's Twitter feed, the username is @GuardianTW, or leave a comment on the blog. You could even hit us up on our Facebook wall, as I believe the kids say these days. They probably don't say it like that though. Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week, so it just remains for me to thank the Singularity University staff and students we heard from, as well as our producer, the ever-reliable Scott Corley, who's off on holiday for a few weeks now, so I hope you enjoy it, Scott. As for me, my name's Bobby Johnson, and thank you for listening. See you next Tuesday.